As the 2020 campaign heads into the final stretch here in Florida, activists in Duval demand easier access to mail-in ballots. Good morning. Hope you had a nice Labor Day weekend. We are back in studio and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, voting by mail, the pandemic, and Florida. What a coalition of groups will be demanding this week. Give us a call. Join the conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, a look inside Void's number one in the 904 and the list of winners, including WJCT. But first this hour, here's the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health now reports 648,269 cases of coronavirus. That's a one-day increase of 1,838. And just under 12,000 deaths from the disease, with 479 reported deaths from COVID here in Northeast Florida. And with health experts predicting a second wave of the virus that could coincide with flu season, voting by mail this November will likely be the option for a record number of Americans and voters here in Florida. This comes after a record number of you out there voted by mail in the August primary. And a majority of voters around the country say they want to use the mail to avoid in-person voting. And this is despite the many precautions taken by election supervisors during this pandemic. Now, against this backdrop, a coalition of more than a dozen voting rights groups says they'll assemble later this morning outside the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office. They're asking Supervisor Mike Hogan to send every voter a vote-by-mail application, and they have some other demands, too, as the presidential campaign kicks into the final 60 days. Pastor R.L. Gundy of Mount Sinai Missionary Baptist Church is the Florida Director of African American Ministers in Action, and he's one of the leaders taking part. He's on the line now. Pastor Gundy, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on as well. So I certainly appreciate it.
Good to have you. Here's our question to callers. What are your questions about voting by mail? How do you plan to vote in the November election? Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we're already getting your comments on Facebook. So, Pastor Gundy, a coalition of groups will be getting together outside the Supervisor of Elections office this morning at 11 a.m. with, really, there's nothing else to call it, but a list of demands for the Supervisor of Elections. What are you asking for?
Well, we're asking him about mailing all eligible voters who have not requested a vote by mail ballot. We ask him to send that out to the people of Duval County, and specifically because Florida is one of the world's biggest COVID-19 hotspots. And Duval County Supervisor of Election Mike Hogan isn't sending voters their vote-by-mail applications, putting their lives at risk. Now, for 2 years, we have been trying to talk to Mr. Hogan about this, and we did not know the COVID-19 was going to come up. But when it came up, that put more urgency on him doing the right thing. And what he did, he mailed the absentee ballot notices out late in the primary. So to avoid that, as his budget is going before the city council right now, they could give him enough money for the early voting ballots to be sent out. They could give him enough money to make sure that we have drop boxes at all of the early voting sites to keep people from having to get out of their car, going inside that place, and having to vote that way. We had one early voting site at a COVID-19 place, which should not take place this time around. It's just not conducive for parking and giving people easy access. In addition to that, he has removed the early voting sites from the University of North Florida and Edward Waters College, but we want him to put it back. Now, here's the problem. 20 years ago, we had 27,000 votes thrown away at Duval County.
The 2000 now, election, Bush Gore. Yeah.
Right. And now here we are 20 years later. And I'm thinking at this point, I'm asking the lawyers in our coalition to go back to the same federal judge and ask him to relook at his order that he gave him about opening these early voting sites. Because I don't see Mike Hogan and I don't see the city listening to us and doing what we're trying to do after trying to work with him for 2 years.
All right. And let me ask you as a follow-up, we have a statement here from the chief elections officer at the Duval County Supervisor of Elections, Robert Phillips. He says that they sent out cards prior to the August primary to all registered voters explaining to them how to request a ballot for both the primary and the general election, and that they do not have the time or the resources to send another mailing prior to the November election. What's your response to that?
He has it. His budget has not been approved yet with the city. So we emailed every city councilman about this same issue and asking them to give him the funds to make sure they could do what needed to be done. Now, here's the problem. That is an excuse. When the state of Florida Secretary of State is mailing out 4 million cards about people being eligible to vote and making sure that they have a right to vote, they need to do the same thing. It is not that they don't have the resources. It's a matter of whether they want to do it. It's a matter of whether the city want to give them the resources to do it. And we have sufficient time to do that before that budget is approved for October. Now, did he put it in the budget is the better question. If he put it in the budget, there would not be a question about whether there are resources. And it was brought up to the mayor.
Estimate of what that would cost to do that for all Duval County registered voters?
I personally do not have the estimates to do that, but Philip and the supervisor of election, I'm sure they have it. It's just a matter of putting a line item in the budget.
Okay,
it has not been approved.
And let me ask you this as a follow-up, Pastor Gundy. You mentioned the 2000 election when tens of thousands of ballots in Duval County were tossed. And, of course, that election came down to a few hundred votes in Florida. And even though the supervisor of elections at the time, a guy named Stafford, said that those ballots were tossed for legitimate reasons, there were many in this community that did not have confidence in that response, and they have distrusted the local supervisor of elections office ever since, frankly, because of the bad taste that was left after 2000. So are you asking for these changes and this increased access to mail-in balloting as a way to foster more trust in the process for local voters heading into the fall election?
Absolutely, because every time we've gone to the supervisor election and tried to talk to him, coalitions from around the state, people would literally fly in here or drive in here to get into his office. And then he would say, well, I can only meet with one of you. And the last time we sent correspondence and tried to talk with him, he said, I don't have time to talk to you. He has time. He has time to do anything that he desires to do. We just want him to have the better angel side of him to come out and do what's right for all people. It's not about the party. Give everybody an equal opportunity to have access to vote.
And, we interviewed recently the group All Voting is Local. They allege that Jacksonville is not up to par with other large Florida metros in getting information out to voters, making mail-in voting as easy and accessible as possible. Supervisor Hogan disputed that when we spoke to him. How do you think Jacksonville ranks when it comes to other Florida cities, as we look ahead to the final 60 days?
He's an outlier compared to the rest of the people in the state of Florida and around the country. We had to literally threaten to go to court to make him even put the election material in Spanish. He hadn't done it. He hadn't tried to do it. We had to force him to do that. So Mr. Hogan has shown a level of incompetency in that office. He's shown a level of apathy in that office, and he's shown a level that I just simply don't care, and he's saying, you can't make me do anything. That's why we ended up going to have to fight to get the early voting site CWC. Then he said, well, it wasn't a lot of participants. If you look at all of the early voting sites around the city, all of them were low this past primary election and in the past, but he didn't take it out of those other sites. So at this point, we don't trust Mr. Hogan. Let me make that very clear. We don't believe that he's doing that everything he could do. And the city government, the city council, and the mayor, they have it at their hand and their disposal right now to put money in the budget, to put drop boxes down. They have money in the budget to hire more people. They have money in the money that they can put in the budget to send out these early voting ballots that people have a right to vote. And then when he said they can't do it, seniors do not have access to these computers. They don't have excess to go out and find a way to get their ballots. And we don't have enough people to go around to them and put that in the system for them to order an early voting ballot. So they know this, and he knows this.
He's all right. And let me just jump in and say we're speaking with Pastor R.L. Gundy of Mount Sinai Missionary Baptist and a statewide group of African-American pastors in action. This group is part of a coalition of more than a dozen voting rights groups that will be convening outside the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office later this morning, asking for greater access to mail-in balloting and other changes. And so Labor Day is over. We're heading into the final stretch leading into the November presidential election, and we want to know, how do you plan to vote? What are your questions about voting right now? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Pastor Gundy, a question. Since you have him on the air, a while ago he was giving a wonderful invocation. He was invited to give an invocation at the city council, and council president Aaron Bowman turned off his mic, which, you know, is a little unbelievable. And my understanding is Pastor Gundy decided to file a lawsuit. I was wondering if you could tell us the result of that.
Okay, that's not really related to what we're talking about today, but go ahead, Pastor Gundy.
I cannot discuss that issue about what happened. That is still pending in federal court. I have to refer all those issues to my attorney, but we're just waiting to find out what the federal court is going to do. The COVID-19 has slowed everything down.
And given that you've been at odds with the city council on that other matter, what's your strategy to try to get them to play ball with you on this matter?
Well, you know, you have to appeal to the better angels. There are a new group of city council members up there who appear to be taking a good look at everything that has been going on in this community for quite some time, to include the social justice committee that they put together. This is a matter of, why do we have to fight to have a right to vote? Why do we have to fight to have a right to have absentee ballots? Why do we have to fight the supervisor election to do the right thing without having to go to court? I mean, it's just a matter of, let's just do the right thing for everybody in the community. And Mr. Hogan has not been amenable to that. He has not been one who has been really trying to work with us in all these organizations. That's why all these organizations are there. We're going to start a picket line today, and we're going to have a mass demonstration coming up. We're not playing with him. We're not playing with this city, because they won't listen otherwise.
It's 549-2937. Mark is in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. Hey, Mark, you're on the air. Okay, we're having trouble connecting, Mark, but what he wanted to ask was, why is mail-in voting necessary? We can just get an absentee ballot and hand it in, walk it in personally. And, you know, we're getting a number of emails about that, too, Pastor Gundy. Here's one from a listener. There's a 2-week early voting period. Doesn't it make sense to just encourage people to vote early rather than mail in their ballot because of the pandemic?
The problem is that going to an early voting site for many people is just like not going to a restaurant. It's just like not going to a church service. It's just like not going to even the hospital. Every time you go in the hospital at Mayo, if you're going to have an appointment, you got to have a COVID-19 test. It is too dangerous. So you got to give people the opportunity who desire to have an absentee ballot that they can mail in, that they can do it. And you have to have an opportunity for safety reasons. If you put a secure drop box outside the early voting site with someone standing there, they can just drop it in the box. We have to make it convenient for those people who are fearful about coming out into this environment.
And, you know, Mike Hogan has told reporters that have asked for updated information on this that the Duval County Supervisor of Elections is going to send out at least 120,000 mail-in ballots later this month. These are to voters who requested them. So just so we're clear, what you're saying is you want him to go a step further than that. You just want him to send a mail-in ballot to every voter in the county. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. it just makes sense. You know, everybody, back to what I said, everybody does not have access to getting online to ordering those ballots. You know, now I don't know how political parties or whatever they do and how they go about notifying people to do that or how they can do that. But it's simply the right thing to do. And hit the mailing 120,000 out, that's a good step. But we're asking him to go a step further. Give everybody an opportunity to do that so they won't have, because this year, these early voting sites are going to be crowded. And the one at Legend Field where you have people, seniors who are trying to walk, by the time they park and get where they got to go, it's all about 200 yards to get to the place where they're voting. There's not enough parking there. There's a COVID-19 site on the other side. The one at the Iltwaters College, they need to move it from EWC, Hill Suite Center, and put it in the gymnasium. More parking, not it can accommodate more people. The smaller set EWC is just not good for that. But he does not want to move. He basically has an attitude of saying, I do what I want to do. And that's not in a democracy. You can't do what you want to do. You have to do what's right for the people.
And just so we're clear, we have interviewed Supervisor Hogan about these issues, and we will reach back out to him this week as well to get his reaction to today's demonstration. On our Facebook page, meanwhile, lots of comments. A listener says, what could easier access look like? It seems easy to me. A reply from another listener, what if you don't have a car? What if you have an illness that keeps you at home? Are you worried that the post office won't deliver your ballot on time or that your vote won't count? It may seem easy for you, but it isn't for all of us. It's 549-2937. If you're just tuning in, we are previewing a coalition of groups demanding easier access to mail-in balloting that will be picketing today outside the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office. Peter's on the south side. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm sorry, but I'm tired of hearing this, okay? Every single Trump supporter who voted for him 4 years ago is going to go out and they're going to vote for him again. There could be a hurricane, but they're going to get out to vote, and we're worrying about making it easy. Now, if you vote, you can vote for the Supervisor of Elections, you could vote for the mayor, you could vote for the city councilman, you could vote for the congressman and the senator. If you can't get to vote, call a relative or a friend or your church pastor and say, hey, I need a ride. Either if you really want to vote, you can do it. If you're looking for an excuse not to vote, then you can do it. And that's why we're in the situation we're in now.
All right, Peter. Thanks for that. Pastor Gundy, what about that argument that if you're determined to vote, nothing's going to stop you?
Yeah, well, you know, that is a true statement. However, we were not in a COVID-19 environment. Now, if you remember, Mike Hogan, because up until a week before the deadline to request a vote by mail ballot, he was the only supervisor of election of a populous, large Florida county who had not sent mailers to eligible voters encouraging them to vote by mail. Now,
he did later send out postcards to voters giving them instructions on how to vote by mail, right?
Yeah, but he did do that a week before, is what I'm saying. So we don't want him to make the same mistakes that he's made before. People will have rides to the polls and all of that. But most of that would take place probably in early voting as well as during a regular election for those who want to get to the polls and be able to call people. But they have a right to say, I don't want to go to the polls. I want to take my ballot. I want to sign it and I want to put it in the mail and it get there on time. Or I want somebody to pick it up, or I want to be able to drop it off somewhere without me having to expose myself to, especially when it comes to American and African descent. We have the highest rate of this COVID-19 thing. It impacts us more than it impacts other people. So let's just make it
easier for everybody. And, you know, we've got about a 10% positive test rate. It's declined somewhat in recent weeks. We do have a lot of coronavirus in Northeast Florida, although it's not as bad here as, say, South Florida. So I just wanted to add a little bit of that context. But I understand your concern, though. People are still very worried about the virus, obviously, and would prefer to avoid a long line of voters if they could, especially seniors?
Well, let's put it in context from this standpoint. The kids have just gotten back in school. The real numbers are not out. And they say there's going to be an increase in this. We just had the Labor Day. And I pray that it doesn't happen. But if it does, let's just not expose people to this. Send them the absentee ballot. Let them vote and be through with it. It's just simple.
Let's go to Jason.
And all they have to do is
and just and lots
up.
Of calls for you. Let's go to Jason in San Marco. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Melissa. I haven't spoken with you in a long time, and I really appreciate once again your show and give me a chance to share my opinion. I think we need to stop pretending to be the world's greatest democracy. We need to make Election Day a national holiday. It's inconceivable to me that it's not a day people are free from work. They have all day to get their ballot in. We're a nation that's littered with holidays for this and for that. We need to combine President's Day and Election Day into one day, make it a national holiday. It would go a long way toward giving every person an opportunity to vote as opposed to having to try and do it after work or on their lunch break or whatever. I think it would be something easily, hopefully easily done. But any politician who opposes it, then you're going to have to say, what is your motivation for opposing this? Make it clear, please. The other thing is, you know, the whole thing's come down to seven states again. And that is a sad reflection on this country that seven states are going to determine who's the president. And millions and millions of votes cast in other states really don't have a whole lot of meaning. That's my opinion, and I thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason. You know, whether it comes to making Election Day a national holiday, the Electoral College, other reforms activists have called for, like same-day voter registration, ending gerrymandering, ending voter suppression efforts, ranked choice voting. There are so many election reforms we could talk about that would make voting access a lot easier for a lot more Americans, and you're absolutely right about that. But in the meantime, Pastor Gundy, your groups will be congregating outside the SOE at 11 a.m., and do you plan to ask for a meeting with the supervisor?
Well, we've been asking for meetings with the supervisor for 2 years. This is why we're doing what we're doing now. For 2 years, we've been trying to get with him, and maybe we could have helped find resources. We could have did something that make this easier for everybody. Now, I want to make one more statement about this. Several days before the vote by mail request deadline, Mr. Hogan made a token effort to send an informational postcard to voters, making them aware that vote by mail was an option. However, the card failed to include an application, and it contained very little educational information about the process. In short, the application was too little and too late.
You know, I got one of those at my house. It was informative. I'm not disputing what you're saying, that more could be done, but it did explain the process. You can call the supervisor of elections and request a ballot too, can't you?
Can you?
Yeah, you can. You can
All
call
right,
them.
So if they call and they request a ballot, let's give them that. Let's say we can call and request a ballot. But this was, the timing of this is the problem. Because if they called and requested a ballot, they would have not gotten a ballot in sufficient a time enough to vote. This is what we're trying to say.
I understand.
Let's do what we need. Yes, let's do it now. Let's not wait the 2 days before this starts.
And we will continue to follow this, and I want to thank you for your time. He's Pastor R.L. Gundy, Mount Sinai Missionary Baptist Church, and the Florida Director of African American Ministers in Action. Many groups will be getting together at 11 a.m. this morning outside the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office as we head into the final 60 days of the presidential campaign. Pastor Gundy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us on. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Much more still ahead. Meantime, later, a look at the winners of Void Magazine's number one in the 904 readers poll. And yes, we're pretty excited that WJCT is on that list. But up next...
Scholars will agree that there were descendants of Jews who came here at that time. Because of the nature of the Spanish Inquisition, that became very much a force here in Florida.
The role of the Jewish community in the founding of St. Augustine. After this.
am Heather Schatz, a producer, and I get to work with talk show host Melissa Ross. Coming from national TV and radio, I've known hosts who are among the best in the business. But there's something really special about Melissa. She puts nervous first-time guests completely at ease, then turns around and gets the most seasoned pro to answer tough questions, holding those in power accountable. That's what we do here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear the world. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, St. Augustine was officially founded on September 8th, 1565. You think of the Spaniards when you think of St. Augustine, but Jews of the period were also on the ground right from the city's earliest days. I learned more on this September 8th anniversary of the nation's oldest city from Rabbi Merrill Shapiro. He's with the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society. Rabbi Shapiro, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
And thank you for highlighting the importance of our community's history.
Sure. So today marks the 450th anniversary of the founding of St. Augustine, September 8th, 1565. Tell me a little bit about the role of the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society in educating us about this incredible history.
We, of course, we stand on the shoulders of giants who have explored the founding and the history of St. Augustine itself, starting again on September 8th, 1565. But we have added an extra dimension growing out of discussions of the recognition of the fact that there had to be, scholars all agree, that there were descendants of Jews who came here at that time. But because of the nature of the Spanish Inquisition, that became very much a force here in Florida. And people think of the Spanish Inquisition as being across the ocean. It was here, and it was in effect in Florida and had an important influence. The Jewish identity of those early founders was suppressed, and we've been able to identify by name someone who was here in 1577, Antonio Martinez Carvajal, whose scholars agree was a descendant of Jews, and perhaps a cryptid who was practicing Judaism in hiding, but it could only be done in hiding. Otherwise, those who were engaging in Jewish activities would be turned over to the Inquisition courts, tortured, and perhaps even worse.
And that happened here in the early Florida of that time. That was happening here.
There were people who were turned over to the Inquisition. Trials actually occurred elsewhere, often in Havana, for example. Remember, Florida was not quite the end of the earth, but it was close to the end of the earth. And nobody wanted to be here. There were too many bugs, too many snakes, alligators, and so on. And it was hot. And so there was no establishment of an Inquisitional court, but the church and the Inquisitional authorities could send someone, and did send people from St. Augustine to be tried, to be held and tried by the Inquisition in Havana.
What else do we know about the early Jews in St. Augustine and the role they played in settling the town?
Very little. Again, they could not, all their evidence had to be destroyed. Anything that would associate them with Judaism would lead to suspicion that they had falsely shown their allegiance to the church. So very little found. However, as I mentioned, in 1577, the main harbor pilot in St. Augustine, and it was a tricky harbor to navigate because there was a bar across the entrance and wasn't removed until the Army Corps of Engineers came and did it after World War II. But he comes from a family, the Carvajal family, that a professor, Roger L. Martinez, at the University of Colorado, who in Colorado Springs, and who has done extensive studies in Spain, has recognized as part of this family that we're in all, in so many ways, descendants of Jews. So Antonio Martinez Carvajal in 1577 was here as a harbor pilot. We can't say specifically what Jews did because of that being hidden. We do know that Jews could not hide one particular fact about their existence, and that is that they were greatly more literate than the Christian fellows, the Catholics who were in the community. And so it would lead us to believe that there was a rise to the top of the descendants of Jews, but there's precious little evidence, I'm afraid.
Hmm. So it's interesting to get this perspective from you because, of course, we think of St. Augustine as a place that's just laden with history, but there's so much that we still don't know. Right?
Right in our own backyard. And this grew out of the sense that the 500th anniversary the 450th anniversary, excuse me, in 2015, would be an entirely Catholic affair. And Catholics have a right to be proud, and of course, and Catholicism is part of the very fabric of St. Augustine. But we do have to take a moment and step back and say, wait a second, there's more to it than meets the eye. And in fact, history in general, I think, teaches us that if we only take a very casual, cursory look at what's around us, we miss an awful lot. And here we're missing the Jewish community. I don't know if we can call it a community that was established first. By the way, if you ask most Jews who are knowledgeable in the United States where Jews first came to this country, will it be this country, they would tell you New York, of course, New Amsterdam at the time. And we're here standing up saying, wait a second, here in far-off St. Augustine, Florida, we have something to say about that.
And so the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society was formed for this purpose, to educate and learn more, right?
Yeah, initially to represent the interests of the Jews, the descendants of Jews who were here. And by the way, we regard it as a repatriation of the souls of Jews who died thinking that Judaism might end entirely back 450 years ago, and we would all assimilate into Catholicism and Judaism would be gone. And so we are repatriating their souls, bringing them back to Judaism, even when we're not entirely sure of their names. By the way, we have a great list, thanks to the St. Augustine Foundation and to the St. Augustine Historical Society's archives. We have the names of people who were here in 1565, and we think by their names, we can determine that they are, in fact, descendants of Jews, but that's not a certainty either. And so we are here to represent their interests. Only later, by the way, did the Historical Society discover that in the 1840s and in the beginning of the 1840s and certainly in the 1880s and 1890s, and of course in the Civil Rights era as well, Jews had a great deal to do and to say and a great deal of influence in St. Augustine. And that surprised us. But we were most interested in the beginning and what happened around the beginning in 1565.
Right. Now, we are in this era of social distancing and Zoom, but what can we look forward to from the society in the fall and winter as hopefully people can start getting together a little bit more again?
We would love to get together, but we've also discovered that if we were to call some kind of event, people don't want to come. They don't want to endanger themselves. And so we are beginning to make arrangements for scholars. It's Zoom and the like, and streaming are great benefits. So we can have a scholar from Spain or Israel or the Southwest United States come and talk to us on screen in a Zoom event. So we are planning that We are working on a presentation by this scholar, Roger Martinez, in Colorado, who will talk to us, Professor Benjamin Gamble up in New York, who's studied Jews in early colonial America, and we are eager to make the use of this time in learning more about what it must have been like to be a Jew in hiding in the face of the Inquisition.
Lots coming up then. Well, thanks so much for joining us on this September 8th, Rabbi Meryl Shapiro. It's more about the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society. Thank you so much.
And thank you for calling attention to this important aspect of St. Augustine's history.
Well, are you reading more in this pandemic? Here's a suggestion that reads just like a novel. It's a fascinating and detailed account of the chase for Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth. This month's First Coast Connect Book Club pick is Manhunt by James L. Swanson. Our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, is on the line with more. Hey, Stacy.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. It's so good to hear your voice. And what a great topic as we head into the fall election and in a divided America. This is a Civil War era book about Lincoln's assassin. Why did you choose Manhunt?
Well, you know, they say there are over 70,000 novels written, books written about the Civil War since the Civil War ended. So you have a lot to choose from. But this book reads, it's nonfiction, but it reads just like a novel. So this follows the 12-day chase for John Wilkes Booth after he jumps onto the stage of Ford's Theater and escapes out the back alley. So you are really there each step of the way. And Melissa, as a journalist, you will respect this. It is incredibly detailed and well-sourced, and it's written brilliantly.
It sounds great and fascinating, and I think people will learn a lot because I don't think people realize that it took 12 days for authorities to catch Booth.
No, and you know what? He almost got away. It is remarkable that thousands of people were looking for him, and he almost got away. And to think what would have happened and how we would have viewed this assassin had he lived, you know, this book really gives you pause. And for people who don't like to read nonfiction, I would say give this a try. I will not say give this a shot because that'd be a horrible pun.
Yeah.
But give it a try because it really, truly, it reads like a novel. And if you do like historical fiction, well, this is really historical. And like I said, well-sourced. And we have so many books to choose from so many Lincoln scholars, from David Blight to Henry Holzer and Michael Kaufman and Terry Alford. But really, for an introduction, it's really outstanding. And I look forward to discussing it next week online. And anyone is welcome to join if they want to go to chapterendnotes.com and sign up.
That's
really
right.
Really a remarkable book.
You'll be discussing Manhunt, the 12-day chase for Lincoln's killer by James Swanson. Next week, September 16th, 7 p.m., you can go to facebook.com/chapterendnotes to sign up. And, you know, people don't stop to think about the fact that in this era where we're concerned about white supremacists, obviously, that's really what motivated Booth to kill Lincoln, to assassinate Lincoln. He was essentially a white supremacist.
Yes, he was a racist. He believed slavery was a blessing. And once Lincoln decided and made it clear that the Civil War was about not saving the Union, it was about slavery, that was a game changer. He had had enough. And so this book explores, was it a conspiracy? Was it not? What was the actual trigger? Was it the inauguration celebration in the city of Washington, D.C., where everyone is so happy the war is over? You know, was it Gettysburg and when he said the Emancipation Proclamation? Was it when the band struck up Dixie? which he said, which Lincoln said belonged to the Union and not the South. These are all things that, you know, an accident never happens in a silo. It's a domino effect. And all of these things, I believe, my takeaway from the book is we are dealing with someone who, is, you know, lives based on fear and therefore has to feel better than the other. He felt threatened. He has a lot of family dynamics, I believe, that play into that. But ultimately, when you work from fear and hate, disaster always results. And you never win. And of course, he goes down in history as this despicable creature.
Right. Now, this book also includes illustrations, even maps. Mm-hmm. So it's a treasure trove for anyone who loves that Civil War stuff, that Civil War history.
Yeah. And believe me, it's amazing to think that, you know, we reenact the Civil War. We can go down 10 to the Battle of Alusky every year. I don't know about this year, but every year, and we can celebrate and we reenact. And do you know that more people dress up as Confederate, the Confederate side, the South side, than they want to dress up and be a part of, you know, the Union? So that makes us think, what is this myth of the lost cause? What is this myth of loving an underdog? And really, Melissa, what happens to our memory when we decide as a country that both sides were right? What does that do to us? And this book, James Swanson, because he takes us hour by hour through this great chase, we are privy to what Booth was thinking. We are privy to what the pursuers were thinking. And it really broadens our understanding of our identity as Southerners, Northerners, as Americans. And there's a lot of lessons in here that are chillingly relevant to today. So we can always learn from literature. And in this case, it is nonfiction, which I'm not the biggest fan of because I love a good story. But this is written so well, I cannot emphasize enough that listeners need to put this on their bucket list for reading, particularly as we enter this election season.
So join Stacy next Thursday, September 16th, 7 p.m., for her online book club discussion of Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer by author James L. Swanson. You can sign up at her website or go to her Facebook page. Just search Chapter End Notes. So good to hear your voice, and I'll see you soon, I hope. Thanks for the great book suggestion.
Thank you, Melissa, and thank you for everything that you do.
In a moment, WJCT rolls in the number one in the 904 readers poll. We'll take a look at all of the winners after this.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
Netflix started sending us DVDs in the mail and went on to transform how and what we watch on TV. But what's it like to work there?
We manage on the edge of chaos. But the benefit of that is great creativity.
I'm Amy Scott, a conversation with Netflix CEO Reed Hastings on the creativity and the chaos inside his company, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, former FBI Special Agent Ali Soufan, who investigated international terrorism cases, including the 9/11 attacks. He opposed the CIA's use of waterboarding and other forms of torture on high-level al-Qaeda detainees. The CIA redacted his 2011 memoir, The Black Banners, but now it's being published in an unredacted edition. Join us.
Today at noon, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The world's kleptocrats are richer and more powerful than ever. And according to author Tom Burgess, they're the reason why the FBI is now investigating the deaths of two former mining executives in 2015. It's one of the revelations in his new book, Kleptopia, a story that connects the dots from the Kremlin and Beijing to Paris and the White House. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, we've been talking about elections this morning. Speaking of which, Void Magazine just conducted a poll of a different sort. Thousands of voters selected their favorites for number one in the 904 in food and drink, people and places, health and fitness, shopping, and so much more. We are so excited that WJCT is a winner, thanks to all of you out there who voted for us. Editor Matt Shaw is on the line to tell us more about the results. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you on the show. And number one in the 904 has really taken off. This reader's poll is really becoming a coveted badge of honor. So we're pleased to say your readers chose WJCT as their number one radio station.
Yeah,
and I'm excited to be the number one radio host in your reader's poll. So tell us a little bit more about some of the other winners.
Well, I think, like you said, it's a popular issue, and I think especially right now, ultimately, I think everyone, given the circumstances, just really wanted to win, and so we're seeing like that reaction. You know, people are just excited to celebrate, and it feels a little bit like normal times again to be doing number one in the 904 and celebrating all these businesses and entrepreneurs and people in arts and culture. But I will say, like, every year, you know, this is the Reader's Poll, so it's the one time a year that I kind of take my proverbial or my hands off the proverbial controls and let the readers sort of, like, dictate what's in the pages. So I'm always, you know, every year I'm surprised by what comes out and excited just to see what, you know, what our readers think about what's going on in the city.
Yeah, these are the People's Choice Awards, so to speak, and... people can pick up a print issue of Void. It's out for the month of September. You are back to printing after the pandemic slowed things down for a bit. Tell us about what you have planned for all your upcoming issues as well.
Well, we're just going to continue, you know, we've really found our stride, I think, with promoting like arts and culture and entrepreneurship and things like that. And I think just with all the great photographers and writers that we have on staff, you know, there's a wealth of information and good content to put out there. So that's kind of our niche right now is focusing on promoting all the cool people doing cool things. So that's our plan for the rest of the year. And we've got another issue coming out in November. And some other surprises before the end of the year I won't give too much away.
That you won't give right away. You know, and Void kind of started as I'm generalizing maybe a little bit, but as sort of a surfer, skater publication, but I think it's really grown beyond those cultures. It really kind of captures the unique Duval, not just the youth culture, but mainly the youth culture here, because this is the youngest major city in Florida, and people don't always realize that. And I think you, is that part of your intention to capture that?
Sure. And I think, you know, you're not wrong saying that. I've been at the magazine for 2 years, and I still, you know, when I tell people I work for Void, you know, often I hear like, oh, that beach mag or the surf mag. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, we've worked really hard use our pages as a platform for promoting, local artists and local musicians and people doing cool things here in the city. And it's grown to be more than just surf and skate, which are cool things near and dear to our hearts here. And I think they make they're just a small piece of what makes Jacksonville kind of a distinctive place to live. So,
absolutely. So as I mentioned, the new issue of Void is on newsstands now. Pick it up anywhere you're out and about around this community. Check out their number one in the 904 poll and see what else is inside the pages of this gorgeous locally produced magazine. And thanks to all of the Void readers out there for choosing WJCT, the number one radio station in the 904. Lots of competition for that award, Matt, so we were really excited to win that from your readers.
Oh, it's so well-deserved. Yeah, you guys deserve it.
Thank you so much. He's Void editor Matt Shaw. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. Meanwhile, we really always value your feedback. We listen and to all of your calls, and we read all of your emails. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, make sure to catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock here on 89.9, or check out our podcast, which will be up later today, wherever you find your favorite podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow and look forward to connecting with you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.